Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Over the past 10 years, the neglected literary form of the memoir has come to the fore, with both professional writers and non-professionals recalling the past in order to help all of us better understand the context of our times. These works fill the gaps between dates and trends and demographics and economics, not with data, but with personal reflections, stories. Tonight we'll talk with two such memorialists. Writer Celia Morris's first husband was the prominent Harper's Magazine editor and writer, the late Willie Morris. Celia Morris chronicles life in the world of letters from Texas to New York to Washington, but from the perspective of a young woman growing up and living in the midst of the modern women's movement, from its beginnings up to the present. Esther Kahn, our second writer, is a teacher and philanthropist. Her purpose, writing at age 87, is perhaps more immediately personal, to memorialize her late husband, Arthur, and to tell the multi-generational story of three families, immigrant and established, who in Boston became intertwined and thrive. Our first guest tonight is Celia Morris. Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas.
Thank you, Ted.
Let's begin with the ending. One of the conclusions you reach is that the traditional family, the nuclear family, creates about as many problems as it solves.
That's certainly true for a good many of us. I do think that for some people it's still more workable than it is for a number of others.
All right. What do you mean by the traditional family causing problems that people live with the rest of their lives?
Well, I was born to people who had been scarred by the Depression, and it was very important to them to keep their families together, very important to my father, who grew up in poverty, to provide well for his family, and for my mother to do the traditional things that women had done and do them smilingly. And theoretically, it was fine, but they had a relationship that became increasingly corrosive as the years passed, and they didn't believe in talking about it. They didn't know how to talk about it. And I think the scars, the psychological scars, were quite serious, and I had the good fortune in my 30s to go into psychoanalysis in New York, and it was extremely painful, but it did, I think, save my life. I didn't know what was causing my problems. Mm-hmm. The point was to keep working hard and making good grades and behaving in what seemed like a responsible manner. And I think that was a formula that many of us tried for. And it didn't work for some people I knew the best. And one of the things, of course, that I write about that was so important in my own life was that being an equal partner in marriage was a necessary thing, but I got myself into two marriages in which it turned out not to be possible for my husbands to live with a person who was equal. And they're different strains that came out of the same tradition, but they conflicted in ways that we didn't expect.
Is that inequality part of what you mean by traditional family structure?
I think that it's pretty much, it's unusual to find people of my generation, I'm now 65, in which the marriage has been a marriage of equals all the time.
Is that possible? I mean, given human nature and...
I think partnership is possible. Now, whether it's equality, one of the things that it takes is a man who recognizes the value of a woman's contribution, even when in terms of the world it is not rewarded as well.
Well, let's step back for just a moment. Your father was such a man. Your father
Absolutely.
Was everything that you might have hoped for. He was encouraging, you know, follow your star, go as far as you can,
right.
Building you in every way.
He supported me in very, very important ways. He really cared.
He did. And you actually conclude that you may have married your mother on a couple of occasions.
I do.
Rather than modeling
exactly
your father. And yet, if she was cold and if she was distant and unhappy, it was in part because she wasn't
being recognized within her own marriage as contributing something that was absolutely critical. And his disdain however much he'd tried to hide it or didn't feel that he was showing it, ultimately was very poisonous.
So what would you suggest as an alternative to the traditional relationship? And do you see it anywhere?
See what?
Today, this kind of openness partnership.
Well, I'm staying with wonderful people in Boston who grew up in Dallas, went to the same high school, Martha and Henry Jacoby. And I think they have a marriage that's essentially a marriage of equals, so I think it can happen. And I do think that so much has changed. I now have my golden standard for marriage comes from my namesake, Celia Duggar, who with her husband, Barry Barrick, are the New York Times bureau chiefs in New Delhi. They cover seven countries. They have two children, 6 and 11, on whom I totally dote. And they are equally fine professionals, and he is as much a parent as she is.
Oh, that's great.
She has said to me on occasion, I think you idealize my marriage, and I say, that may very well be true. On the other hand, it's so much better than the ones that we grew up with. So I think that a lot of men now are taking their roles as fathers seriously in ways they never did.
Well, I think that's pretty clear just in terms of interacting with youngsters,
right?
Which was sort of not allowed by that prior generation.
Right.
Well, let's step back for a moment and find out how you arrived at this point. Tell me a little bit about growing up in Texas, about the structure of the family, about your circumstances, and where you went to school as one of the sweethearts of University of Texas.
One of the things, I was struck once again by how very privileged a life I'd had. So did Martha growing up in Dallas. We were white women in a profoundly racist society. We were born to middle-class families, had good public school educations by the standards of the time. We were healthy, which, of course, we took totally for granted, not understanding that it was the bottom line for everything. Decent enough looking, brains that, by the standards of our time, worked fine. But because I had grown up with this troubled family situation that nobody talked about, and therefore I had no idea how to confront, I thought I needed to marry somebody, and marriage was an assumption in those days.
The MRS degree, I
right.
think.
Right. It was just part of the given that we had, that women who had the opportunity, who were heterosexual women, and we didn't use that term then because it was assumed that everybody was, would marry sooner rather than later. And some of us intended to have paying jobs, but mainly what we expected to do was work. And we would work at the things women had traditionally worked at, which include community building. One of the things that's problematic about the world today is that the women who used to make the libraries work, the hospitals work, the elections work, communities and everything, now they have paying jobs. Nurses used to be all women. Teachers, our schools were good schools. They were orderly schools. The teachers knew what they were teaching because that was one of the few options for women. And if the culture would go back and start rewarding people for teaching children, for being nurses, and really mean it, give them better salaries and all. I think a lot of people would go back into that because it's much more gratifying.
But now, here you were, a freshman at the University of Texas at Austin, having told your father, no, you were not going to Rice,
right,
even if it was a better school because it was too close to home. You wanted to get away.
I don't think I said that, but everybody knew that's what I meant.
Very good. So you're off to the University of Texas, but you did not major in home economics,
that's right,
or nursing or elementary education.
Right. I took a liberal arts course. I'd gotten it was called Plan 2. It was sort of colloquially known as our Yale College, or I suppose since I'm in Boston, I should say Harvard. they promised, they took 100 freshmen, promised them the best teachers. It was a core curriculum, and it was you know, the old style Greek and Roman civilization, biology, physics, and then it got more concentrated, of course, as the time went on. It's the sort of thing that had we had a really good public school education, we would have started in high school, but we didn't. That's just the way it was then. And it was very exciting, and I am never once regretted what I did, but I ended up without anything that you could say you can make a living on, and I eventually got a PhD in English, but that took quite a long time. I was well into a marriage that had begun to turn destructive before I got the PhD.
And well, let's talk about that for a moment. You were graduated with an excellent degree, and then you married, mm-hmm. but not immediately.
Not immediately.
What happened? How did you meet Willie Morris?
I met Willie at the end of my sophomore year. It was at a football game, touch football game. I can't remember much else about it. And he was a guy from Mississippi who had been writing in the Daily Texan, and he had he wrote very funny things, and most of the people I knew were not funny.
They were serious because it was the late 40s and the early 50s.
Well, they were more earnest. Yes. Earnest is one of the words that Martha and I have been using today to talk about
this. This is Martha Jacoby, your close friend.
Right, and we were really earnest. And Willie was serious but funny at the same mm-hmm. time. So it was a different kind of style from what I was used to. But one of the major things that had happened was in my sophomore year, the Brown decision came down, mm-hmm. which was to prohibit segregation that separate is not equal,
like, and reversing Plessy versus Ferguson,
exactly,
and Brown versus Board of Education.
The race issue became the really serious issue for some of the people I liked the most and admired the most at the University of Texas. And this was an issue on which most of the people I had gone to school with in Houston, and actually most of the people I knew at the University of Texas, were not going to take as a serious issue, or were going to do a rear guard action fighting against. But Willie was somebody who was from Mississippi, took race to be a very serious issue, took a progressive position on it, and however many mistakes I've made in my life, I didn't make the mistake of marrying somebody whose politics I couldn't agree with. Now, I refer to my liberal folk hero ex-husband. I think I probably took all that too seriously. And in the course of writing this autobiography, I understood why that was true. But I didn't know as a woman how to fight the issue of race. When I was young, women didn't fight.
You were taught not to be angry.
Taught not to be upfront.
Yep. All of that.
And I didn't feel comfortable in the church at that time, and it was mainly through the church that people were fighting it. So I married eventually two men who fought that issue very straightforwardly and powerfully. One is a writer and one is a politician.
And while they were out there, you know, doing these wonderful liberal things, they would come in and close the door and say, "Where's my mama? I can't get from the bed to the door without her help."
Yeah, you said that. I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. I read it right in there.
Well, there
so it's one thing to be publicly liberal and to have wonderful ideas in terms of changing the world, but it's kind of tough to change your perception of yourself, mm-hmm. either as a male or a female, mm-hmm. depending on the family you grew up in. And
that's
you had
right.
some problems
that's
in right. dealing with Willie with that.
Absolutely. And I had problems within myself. You know, theory is one thing, and being able actually to act upon it something else. And there were just vulnerabilities that I had that I didn't understand because we were not invited then to understand them. I do think that therapy analysis, that there is a whole language of psychology now that was not accessible then. It may not be as effective as it ought to be, but I still think it's better that people know that there are people who take seriously and talk competently about the spiritual life, the psychological life, even if some of the diagnoses turn out to be wrong.
So off you went with this young writer, and the world was your oyster, and things were all going to be great. And you suddenly found yourself schlepping the groceries up 6 flights in New York.
Well, that was in New York. This was after 2 years in Oxford, which was a very magical period in my life.
We're skipping over the magical period. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, one of the things that I am very grateful to Willie Morris for is for taking me to Oxford, where I got to spend time with some of the people who are still trying to make our world much better. One of them is Neil Rudenstein, who just became an ex-president of Harvard University.
When did David come in?
David was born in Oxford. And then there was the 2 year period when Willie was the editor in chief of the Texas Observer, mm-hmm. which fought the good fights political fights in Texas, and it was read by people all over the country. It was one of those small journals that influence is much larger than its circulation.
And
I believed in all these things. I believed in the positions he was taking. I met lots of people I would never have met before, and otherwise.
Your role was one of support, but you also agreed with what was going on.
Absolutely. And then I said what I needed to be a whole person, I was going to have an intellectual life of my own, and I started doing a master's degree. Jack Fisher, who was the editor-in-chief of Harper's at the time, former Rhodes Scholar, had written Willie saying, I like what you're doing, and what would you think about coming to work for me?
Ah.
So he checked out New York and decided that's what we were going to do, so we end up in New York
Third floor walk-up. And what year was this?
1963.
The year Betty Friedan's book was
published. And I didn't notice at the time.
What broke up your marriage? What essentially was the catalyst or...
Well, sexual problems were involved. Alcohol was involved. The fact that my husband didn't take me seriously as a person who thought and felt, and he was in
a
this
colleague.
Very exciting life, and our son and I were the backgrounds. But he wrote that. Somebody wrote about him. That for him to be editor-in-chief of Harper's was the most exciting thing in the world. And it just blanked everything else out. And I understand that. So I went through the 70s in New York, or up until 77, as a single mother and working and raising a child.
But he was devastated by the breakup.
Right. Well, I'm sure you know that people who are in positions of power often lose their perspective. And he kept losing his perspective never was regained because about 3 years later he threatened to resign from Harper's and they accepted the resignation. He had no idea they might do it.
Yeah.
So that I think it was terribly, terribly sad for Willie that he lost a lot of the things he really cared about. And alcohol did have something very important to do with those things.
So let's go back to Celia. At this point, the child was, about 8 years old?
He was 9 when we were divorced.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you have to make your way now.
Right. Now, mind you, I'm telling this story in large measure because I think it's a story of a significant number of women of my generation who were born into a very traditional world and then lived into this world that you described a while ago, where they can be governors and astronauts and people expect them to be. And this new world started happening after we had gotten married and had children. So we had a thorough grounding in the traditional world, and then we had a sense of the opening up of women's possibilities and an internal sense that we had things to contribute that we needed to find out how to shape and do.
So you're a straddle generation. You're straddling the generation. Yeah. And since then, you've been working at?
Understanding, for one thing. And I took a job as an editor after having been a teacher. And one figures out how to make this work, but then I got fired from a job that I had in which I thought... I don't hide very well the responses I have to somebody, and I did not think highly of my boss for the last year. And I thought, when he fired me, I thought if I'd had the power, I would have fired you a year ago. But anyway, I was talking to a friend And said, I need a good idea. And he said, I will give you Fanny. And this was a reference to Frances Wright, the woman about whom I ended up writing my first book. And at that time, he was thinking of writing a novel about her. And I thought giving somebody their idea was the kindest thing anybody could possibly do. But that's how I got into what has become the most gratifying professional thing for me. It's writing books.
Now, while you were making a living and raising David, your personal life was on hiatus in terms of a permanent relationship until you met Congressman Bob Eckhart.
Well, I'd known him since that period in Texas when Willie was editing the Texas Observer. He was one of the heroes of the Observer. In fact, some people thought that the Observer had been started to support the political careers of Ralph Yarber and Bob Eckhart.
All right.
And he was my political hero. And it turned out that his second marriage started falling apart, and he started calling me in New York. And I thought, my word, what in the world is going on here? And he was an extraordinary, Texas liberals didn't, they're not the most conspicuous people in the world in the 1960s or now.
No, it's really true.
Probably there were a few more in the 1960s, but not many.
Well, Lyndon Johnson comes to mind, but
he
was one of the depression-conditioned young men. Was Eckhart of that group? Tough background?
Yes, well, his father was a doctor, but he was the kind who didn't have much money, but they had a cook.
All right.
So he grew up with all kinds of expectations about people taking care of him. That was one of the shocks that I had when I realized what that meant for me. But he was somebody who was a Texas liberal, and Willie had written about wonderfully in Northrop Home. And there was, for example, one marvelous story that Willie had told about his Mrs. Eckhart, Bob's mother, calling for him during one of the campaigns, and the person on the other end of the line said, Mrs. Eckhart, we're favorably disposed to your son, but we're a little worried about his position on the race issue. And she said, oh, I'm afraid that's my fault. I raised him to be a Christian.
Ah.
He had helped create Barbara Jordan's congressional district, helped support her over a really good white man, who had an excellent voting record, and they had taken some of the black boxes out of his congressional district and put into the one that was shaped for her. You know, gerrymandering is not new in this country, and that contributed to his ultimate defeat. But he was committed to that issue as much as Willie had been. But he liked being a statesman, and he liked writing legislation, and he was very, very good at it.
Now, when that marriage broke up, it didn't exactly break up all at once.
No, it didn't.
You had a kind of a shared living arrangement for a number of years.
I went off to Texas and did a voter registration campaign for a year in the 1983 and 84. Learned, by the way, a lot about grassroots politics, which I then later used in the book I wrote about Ann Richards and Dianne Feinstein running for governor, and then realized in the course of that year that I couldn't really live with Bob again, who just he really needed a nanny, and I couldn't do that.
Okay,
so
I
asked him if he wanted a divorce because I couldn't live with him anymore, and he said no. So I got an apartment about 10 minutes away, and we had this eccentric form of marriage, which lasted for another 3 years. And then he had a stroke, and I came back and did all the work and the caring associated with that. But one of the things that I did was figure out his debt, which he had refused to do, and that was the end. He said,
Well, unfortunately, once you did that, he and the family got very protective about what they were borrowing from, et cetera, et cetera. He broke some agreements with you. You wound up losing the promises that he had made on your wedding day. Fortunately, by this time, David had graduated from Hampshire College, right?
Right.
So he was well launched.
No, he was fine. So I had to choose between being solvent and having my home, and I chose my home. And so I've been living with this awful debt ever since. Never once regretted the choice, regretted having had to make it, because it meant that I lost respect for this person I had loved so much. And but it's been a joyous ride. I've written three books since then, and
one on the damage that women suffer at the hands of men of all kinds. Interviews with 47 women.
Mm-hmm. That came out of the Hill Thomas hearings.
That's right.
A book called Bearing Witness, which, and then the book I referred to earlier about Ann Richards and Diane Feinstein. That was really a lot of fun for a Texas woman to go back and watch a Texas woman win the governor's race for the first time in history in her own right was really exciting.
Well, I must say she was quite ungracious about it, though. She did not want to relive those moments of fear and doubt. She wanted to present the governor as power. You reminded her of all that in your
you're
book.
You're referring to the fact that she was not totally thrilled when my book came out. Yes, and it was pretty funny. My publishers couldn't imagine how anybody could not be thrilled to have a book written about her. And one of my favorite stories is about one of the reviews in one of those journals that goes out to the bookstores and everything. They loved the book and said Ann Richards won not only with the electorate but with the author, and said the only problem they found with the book was that I hadn't made Diane Feinstein as interesting as Ann Richards, to which I said, neither did God.
But, well, if Ann Richards had taken your book in the proper spirit, she might have been reelected. So what's the experience as a working woman in the last quarter of the 20th century? Have you seen changes within the workplace? Are you treated differently than when you first started out? Are you insisting on things that you wouldn't
women
have
in
even
general,
brought up?
I think women in general are. And another of the things we've been talking about in the last 24 hours is the fact that when I was in college, there were not women in positions of any authority in colleges and universities. I had one really good woman teacher as an undergraduate and one really good woman teacher in graduate school, and that's completely changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, however unequal women are in the academy, they're much more present than they were younger, and when we were younger, okay. And I think that's important.
We have four conclusions that you arrive at the end of the book concerning being a woman today, and explain what you mean and how you came to these conclusions. First of all, have your own money and control it.
Right. We found, enough of my friends had a similar experience that if we did not make and control our own money, would end up in marriages in which we were taken for granted or used in ways that we really didn't want to. And I think that's just crucial given the respect money gets in this world. The second thing was
anger.
Using
anger
constructively.
To fuel justice.
Right. I came from a world in which women were supposed to suppress their anger, were supposed to swallow it, were supposed to forgive men, etc. And I think that has been very hurtful both to women and to men. I believe in forgiveness, but only after remorse.
But the way you were trained, I'm surprised that you didn't fool your boss, the one that ultimately fired you, because, you know,
I never
South
was very good at swallowing it.
Really?
That's
South Texas Deb? Gosh. All right. Number three, take responsibility for yourself. Now, that sounds like Polonius to Hamlet. It's been around for a while. How do you mean responsibility? Get rid of victimhood? Get rid of this poor little old me or whatever?
I mean, so many people say, my life was messed up because such and such was mean to me, or such and such took advantage of me. And I want to say, look, everybody has a mixed life, and there are ways in which you get yourself into situations and stay in situations that is your ultimate responsibility to figure out. And, you know, if you stay in a bad situation, don't blame somebody else.
That's sad on you. All right, once again, then back to the traditional family, which was the fourth conclusion. What would you put in its place?
I would, that's too big. You know,
I know, but
we don't
it's a big conclusion. Traditional families create as many problems as they solve.
Well, my last conclusion is if you want to live in a world that has more justice in it, you have to work with other people for it. I'm not saying defeat or destroy the traditional family, because for some people it works. the kind of family that I have, which is an untraditional family, is made primarily of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And a circle of friends can be as supportive and thrilling, I think, as a decent marriage. And I'm not going to argue that anybody who's in a marriage ought to get out. They'll do it if they need to or want to without any urging from me. And I think that's the way it ought to be. But I do think that when you can have a circle of friends like the ones that I have, and I think anybody can if they care enough about other people, that gives the psychic support that we were expecting to have from marriage.
Young women today, control your own money, which means, you know, have a job, have a career. Mm-hmm. But if you marry, most women want a child at some point. Mm-hmm. And how would you merge the mommy track with the career?
Well, I
track?
Think it's very, very hard. The daughter of one of my closest friends read my book, got three copies for three of her friends, and she said, she has two small sons and is married to a doctor, and she said, I decided to take off and to be with my children, and I am treated often with contempt. Mm-hmm. And I think that the sharing, I think men and women have to do basically the same kinds of things. And the sort of thing that I would like to see goes in the opposite direction from what's happening now. I think that people should work three-quarter time, everybody, men and women, and spend the rest of the time together.
If your fellow Texan agreed with that, it might happen.
The people I know don't vote for him. All right.
All right. So what's next, Celia? You're a work in progress, clearly. And what's next?
Well, literally what's next is I'm going to read the Odyssey. I've gone into study mode for reasons I don't clearly understand.
If you tell me it's the original Greek, I will be upset.
No,
thank you.
No, I assure you it's
no
the
IF Fagel, stones
the
here.
The Fagel translation, which is utterly brilliant. And I just finished reading the Aeneid.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, but, you know, I don't identify personally with guys who want to figure out how to disembowel other guys. So I look forward to reading the Odyssey because I do identify with somebody who gets himself into a mess and has to figure out how to get out of it.
I just think you're cheering for Dido myself. Celia Morris, there's an old Midwestern saying that I'll ask you whether you agree or disagree. What you lose on the swings, you make up on the merry-go-round.
I never heard of it. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you
so
very
much,
Celia Morris.
Great pleasure.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien, and we're talking about memoirs, lives remembered. With me now is Esther Kahn, wife, mother, teacher, benefactor, and author of As I Remember It. Esther, tell me, when you look at your parents' marriage, you assume they were mismatched.
They sure were. It was awful.
And you were the third of three daughters.
Yes.
And you felt that you were not a wanted child.
I was told I was not a wanted child.
How did you deal with that?
Not well. I was angry, resentful. And then, of course, when I had my own third daughter, my mother was the first one into my bedroom after the baby was born. And she told me, "Oh, you poor dear. A third daughter, but you'll get used to it."
A third daughter, but you'll get used to it.
Mm.
So how does one come from an unpromising beginning to the stage of life at which you're now at, where you seem to be both very clear about the people in your life and yet accepting?
I had tremendous support from a father. I could have committed murder. And he would convince the judge I didn't commit murder. And if I did, I wasn't guilty anyhow. And I had a husband who stood behind me and said, go to it, girl. You can do anything you want. And, of course, this was at the time when I was a feminist. Most of the couples that we knew, a lot of them were psychiatrists, and they wouldn't let their wives go to work. They could do volunteer work.
Let's go back to the beginning. Your grandfather, in the shtetl, in those years, one person was picked aside to read the Torah and to study on behalf of the entire community. But outside of the shtetl, there wasn't much use for that talent. So when he came to America, he and his family, and for a while your family, had a very tough time. Could you tell us about that?
Well, first, it wasn't as bad as it sounds, because my grandmother, with whom I was very close, had a... she was the most amazing woman.
She had six children, for starters.
She had four when she came here, and then had one born on board the ship, and one born later, which she tried to get rid of, something awful. She told me all this.
She was a great organizer.
We would come down there, I think something like 18 strong, and she'd be sitting there, say, on a pre-Passover dinner. The cooking for a whole weekend would be done. She had the house cleaned from top to bottom and did it all herself. And she would be sitting in the living room, the lady of the house, completely organized.
There were a lot of tensions within that extended family group.
It was something else.
I remember when you introduced Albert to the family. After a very tense half hour or so, your older sister, Harriet, who was about 6 years older than you at the time and not married, said, well, you've had enough time to make up your mind as to whether or not you're going to go ahead and marry her. What do you think? And he said, well, if it were you, Harriet, I think I'd change my mind. But since it's Esther I'm going to marry, I'm going right ahead. That set the tone for the next 50 years.
Well, she was the kind of girl. She was miserable, absolutely miserable. Had a terrible marriage. And
which, by the way, took place 4 years after yours. So she was about 30 when she married. And you were 20.
Yeah. Well, everybody thought I was too young. But I had dated a lot. And when Albert came along, that was it.
But 20 was probably the average age then.
No. No, it wasn't. Because this was the Depression. And the girls hung around with the boys and waited for them to earn $25 a week so that they could support their bride. It was really rugged.
You went off to Radcliffe, unclear really on what you wanted to study.
Well, in the first place, what I wanted to be sure of was that I could get a job. So I majored in psychology because I knew I could get a job that way. My parents didn't appreciate the fact because I was off to get a job at a state hospital. They were horrified because what would a nice Jewish girl do at a state hospital? They didn't know that that's where all the nice Jewish doctors who were becoming psychiatrists were parked out. But anyhow, I got married. And in those days, if you got married, if your husband had a job, you couldn't have one.
Well, and he had more than a job. He was on the verge of becoming the first supermarket specialist in this area.
Actually, he had been sort of thrown into the food business. He was a lawyer.
He was a graduate of Harvard Law.
Harvard and Harvard Law.
And his father said, I've got this wholesale grocery business. I want you with me.
No, it was just, I don't want to work anymore.
Oh, really? Okay. No.
And my husband knew that he had his mother and father to support, and his brother to send through college and probably graduate school. And so that's what he did.
That was 1936. He takes over the... He marries you. He takes over the business from his father, who was going to sell it. Yes. And you start your life together. How soon before you became parents?
We waited. We waited some time. Oh, 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that seemed to be what you did. You got pregnant, and it was very difficult for me. I was devastated by it. I didn't feel up to it.
Mm.
I didn't feel adequate in any way. After all, there was nothing in my background that taught me how to be a mother, because I didn't receive any mothering. And my husband loved me, that's all. And he was always there. He didn't do a thing for me, not a thing. You're not like fathers today. My husband never fed a baby, never diapered a baby, never bathed a baby. I think he missed a lot. But he didn't come from a family like that. I complained about the lack of love I got, but Albert's life wasn't any warmer. He was the crown prince. There was no doubt about it. He always did things right. And when he came home with me, my in-laws had looked at my long red fingernails and wondered how in heaven's name I was going to ever cook for them.
That's right. She can't cook. She can't sew.
She couldn't anything. And yet I was married to the crown prince. And I became the crown princess.
So how did you mother your children differently from your mother? I mean, here it is in the middle 40s.
Lots of attention, which they seem to have forgotten. I played with them a lot. I took them out regularly. I spoiled them rotten. That's what I did. You do what you think is right. You try to be the best person you know how to be. And it either works or it doesn't work. And you can't do better than that.
In 1954, you graduated from Boston University School of Education with
and
a master's degree.
Yeah.
And you taught for 15 years at Bedford High School.
At Bedford High School. I had been lucky enough to meet this woman who I mentioned in the book, who was working out at Framingham. And I was a friendly visitor, or whatever they called me. We were talking about the case that I was working on. And she turned around to me and said, "Esther, how old are you?" Well, it was in my 30s. And she said, "You're too young to play Lady Bountiful. You have something to contribute to society. You get trained for it, and you pay for it and make sure you get paid for it." And I did.
That's right. You went back to college. That was unusual in those days.
Very unusual.
And it was especially unusual that you did not have to work.
Nobody could understand it. Even my sister would look at me when I came into the room and say, "You look like hell." That's a nice greeting. And she'd say, "What are you working for?" My poor mother and my poor mother-in-law, they would get greeted at the bridge table this way. The story was, "What's the matter? Isn't Albert doing too well?" You didn't work if you didn't need it. And in those days, you didn't admit that you didn't need it.
You got the first sex education courses ever taught in the state of Massachusetts into Bedford High School.
Well, that was...
How'd you do that?
Magic. No, a friend of mine at BU had told me that Uncle Sam was offering a certain amount of money At that time, Nicholas Fiamaro was the
Commissioner of Health.
Commissioner of Health. I was very active in Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And everybody at Planned Parenthood scoffed at Nicholas. And I said, he'll be on my side. And I must have come up with something right that he bought. And Cardinal O'Connor was the cardinal at that time. He paid for my open parents' meetings. And he happened to be a very good friend of the man who was the parish priest in Bedford. And I got all these people together and got them on my side. And, there were some women there who would drive me up a wall. I had to be so careful of the way I dressed and the language I used. And, I fought such battles. We had teachers at that time who were the first ones in their family to go to college. So they knew all the answers. And I would have to go in and defend short skirts and engineering boots and all kinds of things. Teachers were going to throw them out of class. And it was terrible because if they were thrown out of class, Mama and Papa had to come up to get them back. And anyhow, I built a strong core of parents from every section of the town.
In the course of the last 80 years, you've seen the family grow from this insular, very tight, sometimes angry,
yeah,
extended group to something that's maybe less intense but more scattered. How do you compare now with then?
Nowadays, there is no such thing as the extended family. I mean, in my family, I've got a granddaughter in Missouri. I have a grandson in Colorado. And it goes right down the line. They're just not together. They know each other. They see each other maybe once a year or something like that. It's too bad. On the other hand, I'm not so sure because it was interesting. I guess I was questioning how good an idea this sticking close together was. Albert and I were known as the Mavericks. We did things a little differently. Nobody's forgiven me for doing that. On the other hand, Albert and I ended up with lots of friends coming from different places, whereas they resented our going off in different directions and not staying within the family. I think we had a much richer life, much more interesting life.
What about the changing role of women? I mean, that wouldn't have been possible in 1920.
Well, I was. I was a feminist. And I was sort of the grandmother. I would go to the meetings when they established an organization, a medical organization, and fought for women's rights. I was a friend of the women who wrote Our Bodies, Ourselves. Wonderful, wonderful people. I held hands for girls who were living openly with somebody else.
Why did you write this book? Why? What was it that
actually, it started because I had to have somebody to talk to. And there was no one whom I could talk. Nobody wanted to hear me moan and groan in my sorrow. And so I thought I could use it as a kind of psychiatric exercise. And if I just was as candid as I could be and get it all out on paper, maybe it would be good for me.
What do you hope that the readers will take away from it?
What it means to have a good marriage, that you don't always feel good about yourself, that you've got to stop worrying about you and think about other people. You know, that's all you can help, is that you did something right along the way.
You're still in your 86th year, reaching out, doing things, making decisions, setting up programs that you believe in, writing. What is your life like these days? How do you spend your
time? Lonesome, terribly lonesome. But that's true of everybody. I do have some great friends who are very young, and they call me and we go out to dinner, and we have a lovely time. Of course, it doesn't happen every week or every month, and writing is very hard for me because basically I'm a people person, and if you're writing, you're writing alone.
Is there anything that you'd like to add, Esther?
I'm planning my next book. It's about a survivor. Not in Europe, but in Shanghai. I have come across no one who knew that there were survivors in Shanghai while the Japanese were there.
That's your next book?
That's right. My next book.
Thank you so much, Esther Kahn, for sharing your memories with us in As I Remember It, and today here on Boston University's World of Ideas.
Thank you very much for having me and inviting me.
You've been listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight we've been talking with two memoirists. Earlier with Celia Morris, author of Finding Celia's Place, and then with Esther Kahn, author of As I Remember It. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. And join the conversation at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, Jake Zuckerman, and Bob Zalis. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.